Pittsburgh, in Momo's Hearing, for these around. We'll just refresh it. There's no reason why. If we have to sleep in the afternoons, we will. Because there's very little left to do now. And it's not as if we spend hours more, we can arrive at any better consensus on the bill or any agreement on the issues that are outstanding. Having said that, I'll hand over to my colleague, and I will come in when and as necessary. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members, and welcome at this joint meeting of the Select Committee for Finance and the Standing Committee for Finance. Zolani, please check on honorable Matlashuping and Zamandi for the attendance in this meeting. There was a decision by the WIP of the Select Committee for Finance, and we must adhere to that ruling. Honourable members, this is an exercise in public participation, taking the MTBBS to be engaged with our stakeholders. What are their views on the medium-term budget policy statement? If they were the Minister of Finance, what would they have said? What will their advice be to the Minister of Finance? So you've got 30 minutes to present. I noted the hand of Honourable Mania.
Chair, just on a light note, I wanted to welcome the statement by the Chairperson of the Finance Committee. It's obvious that he's a man of considerable influence. And given the fact that it's taken nearly 3 years for me to get my laptop and toner for my printer, I wonder if he could use some of his considerable influence to assist me.
Well, I must admit, my PA also got some toner.
Mr. Mania should ask himself, why is it that he's the only member out of 490 that's treated by the staff the way he is? That's the real... We should have a commission of inquiry declared when we finally get the ANC members rolling in. Oh, may I say in fairness to Tandi, she's got family challenges, but she'll be here late. Pinky, I cannot say why she's late. She'll be very embarrassed, and I'll be kind enough not to say, but she'll be here shortly. I don't know why she told Alan what she did. And then Mrs. Nkomo says she can't be here. But I take it you've replaced... Okay, thank you.
And then to the two colleagues that joined us in the staff, you're welcome. And just heard of your background, you will definitely add value to the work of the finance family. That's what we are. We are the finance family. Finance.
Family is the right word, but okay.
Well, yeah, you can play with that expression, but we yeah, well, yeah. You, families also sometimes have turbulence, but you get through it. There are ways and means to deal with it. Yes. Thank you. No, we're not going to social.
I think I should come in. There's a psychologist, not a sociologist, who's written to me to ask if he can write a book on the Standing Committee on Finance and its dynamics, particularly the dichotomy between ANC members and the ANC nominated chairperson of the committee. The TA is irrelevant. Nobody wants to write about that.
No, thank you on that light note. Kusatu, you're on the floor. Welcome, Matthew. You may take your time, take your 30 minutes, and address us. Thank you. Members, the copies of the presentation, have you received it? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and good morning, members and colleagues and comrades. Yes, my name is Matthew from Kosatu, and thanks to the committee for giving us some time just to share our 2 cents of thought on the medium-term budget policy statement. Comrade Chair, I'm glad that members also struggled to get toner, because I had to fly to Johannesburg to get toner after fighting for 3 months, and I had to bring boxes on the airplane. In fact, Michael saw me on Monday, getting 2 of the boxes of toner. I must still go back Friday to collect more toner. But
down the road, that game, you can also buy it. It's a bit expensive.
I tried to get in Cape Town, and I just hit brick walls. I was told that we owe money and other soap opera stories, so I had a MacGyver. But it is legitimately procured. And I think...
Order.
We can negotiate everything. And I think, Chair, also we would like to suggest to the content advisor we'll send them the Nahau membership forms, as Nahau is the dominant affiliate here, and they deliver on performance bonuses and other critical objectives. But yeah, no, more serious, no, Chair. Look, in terms of the medium-term budget policy statement, I think we must say that we sympathize with government. We know it's under very, very difficult circumstances. Not all of its creation, global economic crises, domestic crises, and so on. We're a bit more worried about the budget statement than we saw, so we're a little bit comforted it wasn't as harsh as we feared. And there are many positive aspects to it, which we appreciate, which we'll get into. But I think, Chair, maybe for us as COSATU, the overwhelming concern we've got around all the budgets, including this one, is about what impact does it have in terms of creating jobs. And I think for us, having one out of three workers unemployed long-term is a fundamental crisis. All the good work the government might do will never be sustained if we can't address the unemployment issue. So us, Chair, we're quite worried that government doesn't appear to have a coherent, comprehensive job plan and a program to implement it. Chair, look, we've decided not to focus on Treasury in our budget statement because for us, government is a collective. And it's not just Treasury which must produce miracles. We expect all 35 ministers, all the departments, all provinces, municipalities to come to the party. But I think, Chair, there are some positive aspects to it which we'll come into. But I think you can see the issues we've raised about unemployment, poverty and inequality, jobless growth, declining revenues, and so on. Chair, look, I think we must also appreciate that this isn't an austerity budget. I think we appreciate that government is trying to stimulate the economy, but our concern is that it's not enough, given the depth of the crisis. And again, Chair, for us, the international examples are the United States, China, how they managed to kind of push the economy, create jobs, as well as getting the debt levels under control. Chair, look, I think we must appreciate government's commitment to spend 987 billion rand over the next 3 years on infrastructure. And for us, that's critical to driving economic growth. I think we must also appreciate government not cutting social expenditure, even if there's just small increases, but at least it's not cutting. We have some strong differences with government around the public service vacancies, which I'll get into. The minister raised the issue of the selling of state assets, and I think, again, Chair, we'd want to have an engagement on that. The whole privatization debate. And first, Chair, we're really worried, what does that mean in terms of job losses? What does it mean in terms of income revenue for government and so forth? Chair, I think we do appreciate that government needs to get a hold of the debt levels. We can't have unmanageable debt levels. And I think, Chair, would also want to see us moving away from having external debt, which really puts us at risk to your IMF, your World Bank, and so on, as Deputy Minister Jonas nicely highlighted about a month ago. Chair, look, from COSATU, we're not just about criticizing government. We've also had participating in engagements at NEDLAC around labor market stability and around the minimum wage. We're seeing some progress there. We're hoping by the end of the year we might have found largely to meet each other as government, business and labor and come with some positive announcements. Chair, in terms of revenue proposals, and look, we know government won't make those announcements in the medium-term budget statement, but rather next year. Our position has decided that we're very worried about an increase in VAT. Again, it's a regressive tax. It's going to hurt the working class, the poor, the most, especially if you take into account that inflation tends to be higher for electricity, for water, for food, for transport, for petrol. Chair, we're worried about any possible income tax increases upon the working class or the middle class, again, for the same reasons. We think there is space to increase the income tax upon the rich, without being reckless, but we think there's space there. And we'd want to see government moving towards increasing taxes, for example, on luxury goods or non-essential imports. Chair, we know that Treasury was reprimanded by our women members of Parliament about a month ago around the issue of sanitation, sanitary pads, and zero rating. And I think we sympathize with that objective, but our concern is about enforcement of the zero rating for VAT. We've seen zero rating for brown bread, and yet you see the shops who sell it don't reduce the prices and they keep that extra profit for themselves. So our concern about a good objective might lead to companies simply abusing the system. And we know government will never have the capacity to go and enforce those kind of issues at a shop level. Chair, I think also lastly around the issue of tax, we would want to see government coming with proposals, maybe with the Judge Dennis Davis proposals. How do we use taxes to incentivize the private sector to reinvest, to procure locally, as well as to beneficiate. And I think, Chair, we'd also want to see government cracking the whip upon provinces, municipalities, departments, to ensure that they only procure locally. We still see too often municipalities buying T-shirts from China, for example. And government's got good policies and laws, but they need to be enforced. I think, Chair, look, in terms of expenditure, we do appreciate that most departments, so the critical ones, have had above-inflation increases projected. Our concern around the public service vacancies is that we shouldn't be lambasting teachers or nurses or police officers for wanting to have a living wage. In reality, most of them earn a very low wage, though there has been good increases over the years. And I think, Chair, our plea for government is that to engage with the Public Service Bargaining Council with the public service affiliates, and I'm sure they might be able to assist to say, look, where can we cut the fat, where can we reduce, and so on, so we have a sustainable approach to it. But we don't think the correct position is to simply blame our problems upon a prison officer for wanting to earn 250,000 rand, for example. Chair, we think if you want to cut the public service wage bill, let's see an example set by your DGs, by your pedestal CEOs, by cabinet, even by members of parliament who earn a decent wage and they can afford to forego an increase or have below inflation increases. I think, Chair, we'd also want to see a bit of a reduction of the wage gap in the public service. Chair, we must appreciate the good work government has done to reduce wasteful expenditure. But again, there's more work that can be done. I think if you take any flight on SAA, you can see ministerial officials sitting in business class. And I was on one flight, ironically, ministerial officials in business class. The deputy president was sitting in economy class and not even in a window or aisle seat, but just sitting in the middle with his bodyguards further back. I think for us that's the right example. We have this constant issue with symbolically of ministers and mayors now buying cars. That should simply be withdrawn from the power and let it be a government garage competency. Chair, I think we'd also want to see more work by government to end outsourcing labour broking. Chair, the chief procurement officer has been in the news recently, but I think we feel that his consultant has done some good work around reducing expenditure on textbooks and other issues. But again, we think there's more work that can be done. And for example, Chair, why doesn't government simply ban international trips, except for the fundamentally most essential ones? But it's too often you see in portfolio committees, the DGs overseas. And if we're expecting public servants to tighten the belt, then surely the leadership can also lead by example. Chair, just in terms of a few of the key departments, again, I think we must appreciate government protecting social grants, hiring social workers, and I think, again, we feel there's more work that can be done around dealing with substance abuse. But I think, Chair, one deep gripe of COSATU is that, and members will know very well, we haven't seen the release of the comprehensive social security discussion paper. The minister in his February budget speech this year committed to releasing it by around June or July. And, of course, this committee would know about the engagements around the retirement reform issue. And yet we haven't seen it released. Our understanding is that government itself is not having one position on it. Between Treasury and the Department of Social Development, it appears our comrades and I have not found each other. But our concern, Chair, is that we are rapidly approaching the end of the year. And there's a current retirement reform, or the Revenue Laws Amendment Act, that provision about suspending compulsory annuitization, it expires in February 2018, which basically means by August next year there must be an agreement around the way forward. And so basically we're looking at about 6 months in the parliamentary calendar year next year to deal with it. And so far we've seen nothing, Chair. Chair, in terms of NHI, again, I think we'd want to see government moving with greater speed around laying the groundwork for NHI, around sort of the public health facilities conditions. Chair, we've also seen worrying conditions in Limpopo reports about doctors' posts being cancelled because of the austerity, or not austerity, but freezing the public posts issues. Chair, I think also from government, we'd want to see a bit more work done around alcohol, substance and tobacco abuse. We've seen DTI come with a new progressive bill around dealing with liquor abuse. And I think, Chair, there's been a lot of issues around sugar tax. We've seen business complaining about many job losses. We're not convinced really as COSATU that that holds complete merit. And I think we sympathize with government that we need to address our health issues, because also the impact upon public health infrastructure is massive if we don't deal with issues like diabetes, alcoholism, lung cancer, etc., etc. Chair, I think one thing we must congratulate government is that from 2008 to date, and even for the next 3 years, we've seen a massive amount of increase in expenditure to assist university students. Unfortunately, with the street politics, those good victories kind of get lost in the wind. Chair, I think we are worried, though, that government is not moving with sufficient speed to address the students' legitimate call for free education. We support that for working class and middle class families, but of course the rich must pay. I think, Chair, part of what we're also worried about is that in the fight around universities, the need to fund your TVET colleges is lost. I think also the need to sort out the mess in the CETAs is also lost, and I think we should look at more scope for how can the CETAs work with the Technicons to achieve their objectives. And I think lastly, Chair, maybe it's also a good time to start reconsidering the role of the National Youth Development Agency. They have a huge budget of about 400 million rand, if I'm correct, yet government is battling to find, I think, the 400 million rand for the zero fee increase this year for the above the 600,000 threshold. Chair, I think for us, key, very important departments are DTI and economic development. We think they've done fantastic work in the clothing, textile industries, in the motor manufacturing. We really want to see more money being allocated to those departments and more effort being given by government to work with industry to reindustrialize and to create jobs. Chair, in terms of the Department of Labor, we're worried that because of the vacancy freeze, it's meaning that they can employ less labor inspectors, which means your labor laws are less enforced by government. In terms of the UF, Chair, we know government is always looking at the UAF fund, and for us, we'd want to caution against that very strongly, that this is a solidarity tax by workers for when they're unemployed. It's not a possible way to address government's budgetary crises. Chair, also in terms of local government, look, we're worried about the funding of the local government model. We're not sure if we can continue to having this four-tier level of government, and we think we need to reconsider the role of district councils versus municipal councils and look at a sustainable long-term approach. Too fast. Okay, so my apologies, Chair. Sure.
Turn down the speed a bit.
Chair, in terms of the expanded public works and community works programs, we sympathize with government that it's desperate to create jobs, especially for low-skilled, long-term unemployed people. But we're worried, Chair, that it's become basically a source of cheap labor for municipalities and for departments. Those public works programs are meant to deal with once-off projects. Yet we're finding in municipalities across the country, they're now being used to deal with permanent municipal functions, such as cleaning streets, building roads, laying electricity lines. We've been also told in the city of Cape Town that it's being used to clean municipal buildings. So basically it's become a way of balancing the municipal books. And if that's the case, Chair, then we must reconsider the funding model for municipalities. Otherwise, we're simply going to outsource municipal work for cheap labor. I hope I'm going at a better speed now. Thanks. Chair, look, in terms of basic education, we welcome the commitment to the infrastructure expenditure. But we would want to hear from government, when are they going to finally eradicate the mud schools? That's been a continuously shifting goalpost. When will they finally eradicate your bucket system in the rural schools? We've also had reports which are quite worrying about vacancies being cut in the schools. Sorry, Chair. We received a report in Mpumalanga that about 1,400 teachers' posts were cut. And again, if we look at the matric results in Mpumalanga, we can't afford such drastic cuts. And those basically are normally your temporary teachers. Chair, in terms of energy, I think we must commend government for the massive rollout of renewable energy. We've seen about 190 billion rand of investment over the past few years, about 27,000 jobs. We'd want to see more effort given in that regard, Chair. We were disappointed that the Department of Energy hasn't met its solar panel rollout targets for these two quarters. That is quite worrying. I think, Chair, for us, we see renewable energy as a future, and we would want to see government being bold and simply requiring all buildings over the next, say, 5 years or 10 years to have solar panels, for example, to lessen the electricity burden on Eskom. We are worried, Chair, that every year we see Eskom simply increasing tariffs far above inflation levels, double inflation, triple or quadruple inflation levels, and basically squeezing workers or squeezing industry beyond what they can afford. Chair, we were quite impressed that in the budget statement, government said that renewable energy can be used for baseload energy, according to the CSIR. We know there's always been an argument out of the nuclear industry that you can't use it for baseload. We've seen Portugal, Denmark, I think Costa Rica, now moving completely to renewable energy for months at a time. We've seen Germany moving away from nuclear energy. So for us, Chair, our plea is we can't afford to expand nuclear energy. The price tags we've seen is about R1 trillion. We understand that it might be funded by, for example, a very generous country in Europe, that they would install it for free and then recover the money through tariffs. But again, we're going to simply see working class families, industry being squeezed with unaffordable electricity prices. First, Chair, nuclear energy is dangerous, health, environmental-wise. And we can see much more effort and expansion on renewable energy with very little consequences. Chair, we saw the Minister of Finance made a comment about DERCO, about the expenditure levels. I think we agree with that. And we also want to see all our embassies being tightly aligned to promoting trade. If we have an embassy, that's great, we support that, but let it return all the investment we spent on trade promotion. It shouldn't simply be there for cocktails. Chair, we're quite worried about the public enterprises. Again, we're not sure why we have 3.5 state-owned airlines and why we have not made progress around consolidating it. We think we can do it, and we can do it in a way without costing jobs. Chair, I think also our worry about pedestals is that they are the champions of outsourcing, of labor broking, and also of corruption, unfortunately. We're worried that the government has taken long to bring the shareholder management bill to Parliament. We're also worried about how telecom seems to be outsourcing and retrenching workers left and right. But I think we're slightly optimistic around the post office. A year ago, postal workers weren't getting paid on time, or they got paid half the salary at a time. And workers have been retrenched. We've seen some turnaround there. But again, it's because management has engaged with unions on a turnaround strategy. look, Chair, we do want our ministers to be safe. We don't think they should be molested by criminals. But we're worried that we're spending too much money on bodyguards. I think in the budget statement, an additional $2.6 billion was spent on the VIP unit. Even worse. And you see the amount of bodyguards being allocated to ministers multiplying all the time.
I'm sorry for interruption, Chair.
Sure.
Can I request that the presenter go back to the previous slide and very slow on public enterprises, please?
There's a request. Can you go back to the previous slide?
Sure. Okay, no, thanks. No, basically what we're saying about public enterprises, look, we share government's concern about the governance crisis of different degrees. We're worried about if we can't afford to manage SAA properly, why do we have 3.5 state-owned airlines? We need to have a proper governance intervention. We need to consolidate them and so on without sacrificing jobs. We think we can do it in a proper planned way. But I also gripe, Chair, of all our affiliates who work in the public or the pedestals, is that they are constantly battling with retrenchments, with outsourcing, with corruption. If they raise issues of corruption, they are victimized. This is across the board in the pedestals, from the airlines to telecom to Eskom to the post office and so on. I think we're also a bit disappointed that the Public Enterprises Ministry hasn't tabled yet the shareholder management bill. That has been in the pipeline for a couple of years now. And yet if government is complaining, doesn't have the capacity to intervene, surely there should be fast track in the shareholder management bill. And again, we're deeply worried about telecom. Telecom had about 50,000 employees 20 years ago, is now at about 7,000, and they're planning to cut another couple thousand. And again, when you then find that telecom then outsources that very same work to those ex-employees, but at a lower wage. But we have seen, on a positive note, Chair, from the disaster we saw in the post office a year ago, we've seen some positive turnarounds, that staff are getting paid on time, getting the salary in full. But again, we think the positive example there is that you've got a new leadership, a strong leadership deployed, and the first thing they did was to meet with the unions to find out How can we turn around this public asset, Chair? Chair, look, I was just mentioning it on the VIP unit. I think that we don't want ministers to be victims of crime, but we think there's a space for modesty there. We're not sure if all deputy ministers need a multiplicity of bodyguards, if all MECs need it. I think the average person in the street doesn't know who a deputy minister is or who an MEC or a mayor or a speaker. We even now find DGs or entities, commissioners, receiving bodyguards or chairs of parastatal boards. So that's excessive for us, Chair, for talking about belt tightening. And again, Chair, where the police should be deployed is places like Vandenberg and Khayelitsha. Every year we see the crime levels in Inyanga and Guguletu and Khayelitsha being shockingly high, and we're not getting a handle on that, Chair. So that's our plea around that issue. Chair, in terms of agriculture and forestry and land reform, look, we think there's more support that's needed to be given to farmers, especially emerging farmers. I think we've seen worrying reports from the departments about half of the restitution cases collapsing because not enough support, training, equipment was given to the new emerging farmers. But also I think, Chair, look, agriculture is a strategic sector of the economy, and it's unfair for us to expect it to compete with the EU or the US, where agriculture is heavily subsidized. I think you will see stats in the EU that the average cow gets about $10 a day in state subsidies. Now, that's higher than the farm workers' wages here. So really, I think for us to expect agriculture to compete and to create jobs, we need to sit with industry and with farm workers and farmers to see how do we support them. I think, Chair, a worrying figure in the medium-term budget statement is about the pace with which we are addressing the land claims backlog. I think the report indicated about 400 cases this year. If that's correct, and we've got about 70,000 cases backlog, that's a very worrying situation. I think, Chair, we'd also want to see government moving with speed around providing equity in land for farm workers. Chair, in terms of transport, again, I think, like all members, we'll be deeply worried about the state of affairs in Prasa. It's quite shocking and worrying. Chair, we know SANRAL is constantly asking people to pay e-tolls, but I think we'd rather want to propose an alternative, that we look at alternative models of funding our road infrastructure. If you look at the payment rates for e-tolls, it's clear the public has rejected it. It's collapsed. It's been about 2 years. And again, overwhelming majority is not paying it. I think, Chair, we'd want to see more effort focused on public transport. Chair, without being opportunistic, but I think water's in a crisis. And it's our next crisis like we had with electricity. Most municipalities are shamelessly neglecting infrastructure of water. Maybe it's because of budgetary issues, maybe it's because of capacity or leadership problems, but we really think this is a case for national government intervention. We simply can't also just leave it to the last minute, like with electricity, and then allow a crisis to blow up. We've seen reports of Grahamstown about a year or 2 years ago going without water for 2 weeks. There's reports in Zanin in Limpopo, they go without water for a week at a time. So we think we must have more intervention there. But again, the solution is not to make water so expensive that working class people cannot afford it. Water is a human right, it's about life. We would want to see government start working towards desalination plans, because it's clear we're always going to be a water-scarce country, and we need to find out how can we take seawater into consumable water. Chair, in terms of informal areas, you know, when members travel to the constituencies, they go through Cape Town International Airport. There are two informal areas right next to it. There's one called Malawi Camp. There's one called Freedom Farm. They live without water, without basic services. Those informal areas are more than 20 years old. And it's a shame to go back to them, especially during election time, to say, come and vote, but don't worry about the water, the sanitation issue. We think really government must take advantage of its expropriation powers. If you cannot expropriate those lands for whatever reasons, because of the water table, whatever the issue is, provide alternative land. But we can't have, in Cape Town, for example, 200 informal areas, in the majority of which don't have access to basic services. Or if they do, it's like this area in Khayelitsha, which has about 20,000 people, but about 300 toilets. So I think, Chair, really, it's a shame that we're not dealing with this issue properly. Chair, I think we do appreciate all the good work government has done around housing, But again, a housing model we think needs to be revisited. You know, if you have an RDP house which has cracks before the person moves into it, then it's really a shame, because government's doing excellent work to pump in billions, but because the contractors are short-circuiting the process, people are left short-changed. Chair, I hope I didn't take too long. But I think, yeah, look, basically, for us as COSATU, the key issues is around how we're dealing with the unemployment rate of 33-36%. We're not worried that this budget does sufficient levels to create jobs, to stimulate growth. But we do appreciate government is not taking an austerity approach. We would want to caution government around income tax or VAT taxes increases, which will hit the poor. Let's look at other ways which we can increase taxes without hurting working class families. We would want to see more effort around reducing wasteful expenditure. Again, around the public service vacancy and wage bill, we'd want to urge government to engage with the Public Service Bargaining Council. Let's see how do we find each other. And again, Chair, our issue around renewable energy, leave nuclear energy, and again, to continue the infrastructure investments, to look at the issue of water, outsourcing, and I think lastly, Chair, our plea to government is that they should engage with labour, with business on these issues. We'd be happy to sit with government around ways to cut expenditure, to increase revenues. I think we've shown ourselves to be civilised, decent people at NEDLAC around the labour market stability and minimum wage engagements, and we think there's more space for us. I think, Chair, we're all in the same ship. We can't afford for it to sink, and so that's our contribution to assist government. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew, for your presentation. You mentioned a very important matter about water. The Northern Cape will table a provincial week report next week with one of the proposals that we must look urgently at the harvesting of water. I come from a very, very dry region called Namakwa. You have schools and hospitals being built without gutters. When it rains, the water just runs away. And we sensitize those MECs for education and health regarding this matter. When you get a phone call in the night, sir, we haven't got water at the hospital in Garris. Yes. And the basic thing is just add up a gutter to catch up the water. You've got four tanks. 3,000 litres times 4 gives you 12,000 litres of water, and then you've got reserves. Now, what is so difficult? Thank you for that. We're going to take the next presentation, honourable members. Note down your questions. We'll come to that. Question time, Rural Health Advocacy Project. You're welcome, sir. You've got 30 minutes as well. May address it.
Okay. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Russell Rensburg. I'm with the Rural Health Advocacy Project. And we are here today just to talk about staffing moratoria as well as the upcoming divisions on the equitable share and the impact on healthcare service delivery to our rural populations. This is the second time that the RHAP has been able to come forward before a parliamentary committee. And I think last year we made a submission to the Appropriations Committee and covered some of the areas that we will be covering today. These included, obviously, the allocations to cost of employment, municipal... The RHAP advocates for the provision of healthcare for rural communities. As many of you know, some of you may even be from rural communities. Rural communities make up almost 38% of our population. And we feel that rural communities shouldn't enjoy the same and equal access to quality and comprehensive healthcare. And that's basically what when we look at national policy, that's how we look at. In 2015, RAP made representations to the Appropriations Committee on the Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement. And the core of our statement was around the allocations to provinces not keeping up with the growing cost of employment, that blanket staffing moratoria were impacting on service delivery, And there was this issue of almost like unofficial deficits that were being managed by provinces by way of accumulated annual accruals. We are happy to report that following the statements on the medium-term budget statement in 2015, we had some word from the Minister of Finance in his February 2016 budget statement, where he did issue out the directive for the protection of critical posts in health, education, and in the police service. Following that, we had an opportunity, following our statement or the budget statement in February 26, we engaged with National Treasury and the National Department of Health in roundtable discussions to look at the to develop a policy directive for the directive and protection, the identification and protection of critical health posts. At the moment, we look at critical in a very narrow way. I mean, I think our directive coming out of government at the moment is that we must protect frontline health posts, which essentially just means nurses and doctors. But I think as many of us may be aware here, that healthcare delivery, just like any other delivery, requires like a service platform which is made up of a whole lot of different components to allow for effective delivery. We all know that some of the biggest allocations in our budgets over the last while has been to health and education. And I think a lot of those things now are at risk. We will be beginning to cut on the basic operating environment, making it difficult to deliver effective healthcare services. And, you know, I think with the nebulous sort of protection of frontline posts, I think provinces who are the main implementers in our country have a really hard time prioritizing which posts are important and which aren't. And I think what we've started to see was, you know, there's almost an inertia of action when people don't know what to do. You know, on the one there may be instances, for instance, in one clinic where a cleaner may be more critical than a doctor. If there's six doctors in a community health center and no cleaners, the priority should actually be on the cleaner, because the cleaner can look at some basic infection control stuff. But in the current environment, we wouldn't be able to employ that cleaner because we've got a blanket moratorium. And I think that's the main thrust of our argument is that sometimes the prioritization of posts should be on a contextual and facility level. Right? We said the prioritization of medical, you know, to a large extent has affected other professions such as rehab facilities. We know that we have one of the largest TB outbreaks in the world, which is very coupled to HIV, but TB requires more intensive care than just medicating people with drugs and getting, we got quite high treatment rates, but sometimes part of that healing process is occupational therapy. With the prioritization of medical posts of doctors and nurses, the other allied professional posts have not been protected in the same way, and in some instances are not being filled, particularly occupational therapists, physiotherapists, speech therapists, and so forth. I think in the current budget, in the latest medium-term statement, the minister also said that we're going to our cost containment around cost of employment is going to look around the rejigging of organograms, national attrition, and looking at administrative and management posts. Now, recently we were part of discussions with one of the provinces that sort of looked at their legacy systems and started re-engineering the organogram to fit in line with their budget allocation for cost of employment. The unfortunate thing is that the data that we use to determine how our organograms should look in facilities is often very dated, and it doesn't fall in line with the expansion of healthcare service delivery in the last while. We also heard from our colleagues at Cosato about the continued strain that the economy is having, shedding jobs, and people who were previously under private medical insurance are also now moving into the ambit of the public sector, and I think in a lot of ways we're not accounting for that when we're developing our organogram, because our WISE and data is primarily based on previous historical utilization and doesn't take into consideration any kind of unmet need. In rural situations, 10 times worse. You know, I think if we're in the Makwaland and we have one doctor and two nurses, if a doctor leaves, it's going to take us a year to replace that doctor.
And he's got two doctors now. Yes.
Exactly. So if one of them leaves, the other one becomes overburdened. And it places a strain on healthcare delivery. You know, we recognize the hard work done by the Treasury in containing cost of employment over the near term. But I think sometimes we must be careful that we're not cutting into the bone when we cut the fat. You know, I think our opening statement was a better health for all in South Africa, and all includes everybody, including our rural populations. Our rural populations are probably, in terms of socioeconomic deprivation, some of our most marginalized communities with high levels of unemployment, high levels of illiteracy. You know, unlike the developed world, we actually have quite a youth bulge in our rural communities. And I think it's a ticking time bomb sitting there if we don't look and manage expectations, and as well as providing the kind of environment that fosters development. You know, I think if we go back to one of our biggest challenges within health is HIV. And now HIV is really being driven by our young women between 20 and 24. And the women between 20 and 24 are economically and socially at risk to exploitation, particularly in our rural communities. We know annually when we do our big great treks home, a lot of people are marginalized and put at risk by richer folk from the cities coming to infiltrate communities. So I think we neglect the rural communities at our peril. The other impact of staffing moratoria, like Harris has two doctors now, if one doctor leaves, you know, you won't be able to do outreach services or some of the more preventative stuff that we envisage in the primary healthcare reengineering. I think one of our stated goals in PSC reengineering is to move away from this curative, rehabilitative, medicalized approach to health to more of a preventative health promotion kind of focus. But the unfortunate thing is our budgets, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, do not align with that. You know, in a sense, we're not incentivizing movement towards prevention and promotion, but rather just continuing to fund along the same line. So we've got a new car, but we're putting leaded petrol into it as opposed to unleaded. So we're not running optimally. Now, cost containment, you know, I think one of the biggest things, challenges that we have when we deliver public good, that is difficult. You know, when you run a corporation like ShopRite, at the end of the year, you can say, okay, fine, this is my top line, this is my bottom line, I've made my profit, and it's quite clear. But when we're investing in public services or public goods such as health and education, our payoff is not immediate. You know, so any savings that we make now may come at a cost, and we'll only see that cost further down the line. And some of the costs, the near-term costs of cost containment to the health system is diminished capacity of staff to deliver services. You know, when we don't have a fully functional team to or a fit-for-purpose team to support the contextual challenges. You know, we as staff become, you know, sort of immune. We get to a point where we don't move beyond. You know, I think with permission, what can I rather not say? You know, and medical training is also very much an apprenticeship. You spend 6 years or 5 years at university. And when you come out into the system, there's sort of an intention that you will be under the guidance of an older, more experienced professional who will help you learn the ropes and allow you or back you up for that small margins of error that you have because you're dealing with people's lives. Unfortunately now, we're seeing more and more junior staff in our facilities as managers opt to not employ higher grade doctors to speak by way of cost. And I think this is really just undermining the quality of care that we deliver and indirectly leads to sort of little medical errors. And we know now that after we've tied up our systems within the National Road Accident Fund that medical facilities are now becoming the targets of medical legal claims. And I think to date we've probably got something about 18 billion worth of claims that are in the system that haven't been processed, primarily in Gauteng and in the Eastern Cape. And I think these are the kind of leakages that we can ill afford. So maybe we're being penny wise and pound foolish by cutting staff. But over and beyond that, we also, like I said earlier, I think the healthcare service delivery is premised on a number of different capacitating and enabling sectors. Some of these include like procurement, financial management. Weak financial management leads to leakages. And then most importantly, health management information systems. You know, I think the minister spoke at length about the number of re-engineerings we've had around health information. We don't seem to get it right. But I think for a relatively small investment, we can learn to understand better what we can manage and then also design our systems to be much better. And, you know, I think I've spoken about the medical legal claims, which is something which soon will become a national crisis if we continue to undermine service delivery within healthcare. And then I think beyond the rands and cents, you know, it's very unfortunate that this picture has found its way into my presentation, but we're letting down severely handicapped children, you know, in terms of the facilities and support that they give them. You know, and sometimes the services of an occupational therapist can make the difference between being alive, which I think the first picture illustrates, and secondly, be living and having a stimulated life and being able to access some of the joys of life. And then moving on, as a broader health movement, I think discussions have been ongoing. We've all recognized that you know, the Minister of Health and the Minister of Finance and the supporting community have seen the importance of critical posts within health. But in the absence of like clear guidelines, I think we have to move beyond just doctors and nurses. You know, I think there's urgent need for a deeper discussion on what we need to have a functional health system, given that we invest so much in it. Earlier this year, there was a People's Health Assembly in Cape Town, and I think one of the resolutions coming out of that was that critical posts should include more than clinicians. It should include the whole system, but must prioritize rural, which are some of our most marginalized communities, and primary healthcare level service needs. You know, and here we have to recognize that some players within the system are coming back. When Dr. Mbangashi in the Eastern Cape, he's very far along in his organizational refit. I think over 3 years he's transformed the Eastern Cape Department of Health. They've moved from a series of qualified audits to their first they've got good audit comments, and he's got a good idea. And one of the visions that he's driving there is more devolution within the health system, a smaller head office, you know, and putting power back into the hands of the people who are delivering the services and allowing them to make their decisions. But I think that project's still early, and there are some gaps. But I think we're moving in the right direction in some areas. The issue of accruals is an underreported issue. I think some of these provinces are running accruals in health of up to 650 million rand a year. And these aren't accruals that sort of happened in 1 year. I think a lot of them are running from 2001. And the unfortunate thing is that, you know, accruals is like a payday loan. You know, if they have them in the system, whenever the money comes in, they have to adjust for the accrual, so the net amount that's left to implement services becomes less and less. And I think in the first instance, we need to get provinces to report on the accruals, because at the moment, I don't think there's a clear report, a need for them to report the depth and the width of the accruals, because I think a lot of the inertia around the filling of the posts could be looking at savings to try and pay off some of these accruals. With and now obviously coming into the Equitable Share Fund, where there's been a lot of talk, the minister announced now that we're looking at recalculating the equitable share formula, particularly on the mid-year population estimates. Now, as I indicated earlier, I'm from the Rural Health Advocacy Project. So for us, the impact on the rural needs to be considered. You know, rural populations are generally a lot smaller and widely dispersed. And without knowing all the details, just looking at a purely population-based measures could have a negative impact on the equitable share received by our rural provinces. I think the Treasury has engaged in some discussions around a rural adjuster. And we feel that now, with the recalculation or more intensive look at the equitable share formula, here's an opportunity to finally, like, sort of put this rural adjuster thing to bed. I think some of the things that needs to be considered within a rural adjuster is to look at things like equity versus equality, finding ways to account for the diseconomies of scale in some rural areas, and maybe spend a little bit more time in strengthening some of the systems within our previously maligned provinces. You'll notice that a lot of our provinces that are dealing with massive legacy issues are provinces that had large homelands within their jurisdiction. You know, the Eastern Cape had the Ciskei and the Transkei, and some of those administrations got incorporated into the broader Eastern Cape. And that... Pardon?
Well, carry on. We'll come to question time.
Yeah. You know, and we need to invest proportionally to correct some of the imbalances, because I don't think we've allowed enough of that inequality to be addressed in our first 20 years. So as we move into the next phase of our project, you know, I think I sort of just want to end with our critical post guidelines. As we indicated earlier, I think at this stage we're still sitting with very flat doctors and nurses. And I think we want to reiterate that firstly, doctors and nurses are important, but they are not the only members within a capable health system platform. And the recommendations that we made around to the National Department of Health with Treasury was to look at how we can help provinces, because, you know, service delivery happens through our policies made at a national level. The provinces implement these policies and often also have to manage the budgets to deliver it. You know, firstly, we think critical posts should be defined locally. Right? Locally, we mean at facility level in the first instance. And there's a need to prioritize health professions that can include support staff based on the need. You know, consequences on patient care should be the determining factor on deciding whether post A in facility B is critical under the given circumstances. I think one of the mentions that are made as a cost containment thing is costed recruitment plans. We haven't seen many of these. And there hasn't been a big uptake, and we think there needs to be a bigger push for provinces and districts to have costed recruitment plans so that we can identify priority posts, so that during times of staffing, I think we can make the decision more pragmatically rather than the wheel that makes the most noise getting the oil. And we feel that Treasury can play an active role here ensuring that this happens. I think decision-making on cost-saving and cost-cutting must be made at the district level. And I think we can do this by actually giving districts more access to their budget, giving them savings targets and allowing them an opportunity as a management team to see how they can achieve that saving targets. And I think that process should be informed by principles of administrative justice, you know, of rationality, proportionality, and the overarching constitutional right to the progressive realization of healthcare as promised in Section 27 of our Constitution. I think we need to look at corruption and unauthorized expenditure not necessarily as a system ill, but also start looking at it from a performance management point of view as opposed to punishing everybody for the sins of a few. We need government to provide guidance to provincial treasuries and how to exercise the discretion in protecting health rights, where Treasury directly intervenes in the business of health and health administration. So, in short, that's our presentation is really around that. The better guidelines for the protection of critical health posts beyond just nurses and doctors, but also to include allied professions as well as capacitating professions. We want to get in early on the discussion around the equitable share, to make sure that we're not focusing just on capitation, but are taking into consideration other equity factors. And I think that's the end of my presentation. Thank you for allowing me an opportunity to speak here and to engage with you, and I'm welcome. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you. It's Russell, right? Thank you, Russell. I'm from a very rural province. I was brought up in a very rural area, and I'm deployed in a rural constituency.
And you look rural.
Thank you. Now I feel at home with my people in Namakwa on the West Coast for that remark, co-chair. We invite you, if it's possible, to join the National Council of Provinces on taking Parliament to the people the week of the 14th to the 18th of November in East London, where we will deal with what you have just tabled in this meeting regarding rural development. There was a pre-visit in the very, very rural areas of the Eastern Cape. My brother, hills up, downhill through rivers, you name it. They were there. Go, and there will be report back sessions and a debate on Friday, the 18th of morning, 9 o'clock. So you are welcome. I get carried away when you talk about the rural areas. Honourable members, we've got a good lady, ma'am, in our presence, sitting behind Russell, and she requested also to make a submission. Ma'am, you're very welcome. Rosalind Nyamane, if I pronounce it correctly, you can just say, are you representing a institution, organization? But you're welcome. It's a people's parliament. All our sessions are open, committee meetings, so you're very welcome, and you may proceed. Did you just put on the mic?
Oh, thank you, Chairperson. I was prepared to come and represent something that I prepared, but now seemingly it's not the correct, relevant topic that I wanted to say, because the invitation says the minister is going to present on the 26th, which I read, and then in the public health is coming to present, to take part this today. So I did the tips that were requested to do for the minister after the budget speech. So I can do that. I've got a rough sketch, but I didn't have time to print out the exact topic, the exact face altogether, because the system, it was a new system. It has just set submit and everything was disappeared. Otherwise, I can do that. It's just 3 points that I've prepared. Took out from the system quickly. Can I go on? Oh, okay. Oh, I'm fine. Just
speak to your document.
Okay, yeah.
And you can hand it in.
No.
We can even make a copy that you take a copy back home, and you please table your submission at this meeting. The secretariat will incorporate it into our report.
So can I present and then I'll type this when I'm at home and then set it? It's fine.
No, it's fine. Look, there's no rule that says you have to have a written submission.
Okay.
You have a right to speak. You can take as much time as you need to. There are people writing down what you're saying anyway. You can handwrite it if you like, in any language, doesn't make any difference. But you don't have to make a written submission. There's no rule that says that. So we will hear what you say, and if it's relevant to the medium-term budget policy statement, we'll put it in our report. Thank you.
Okay. I just went back to the introduction of this. Where did I put it? Sorry for... Okay. All right, the topic which I was based on, I will just say a little bit of introduction for these tips. It was three tips that I've chosen, and it was the tips on the budget speech, not in detail, but just generally. And this tip based on the expansion of the principles developed on the medium-term budget policy statement framework, and they extracted from the practices experience actually by the people, which was saving the country for lifetime, for a long time, and these must be inclusively regulated if anything really form part of the framework. Now these are the tips. One, it lies on the quantitative approach, which It was actually, I was just after the pass of the transactions from the lower level of the institutions, any institutions that keeps the worker to work, up to the national level. Because the experience of the people, in fact, they lies, let me say, it's the quantitative approach. The first one, it is the analysis, is the mere practice that can enhance to rate of the collecting the extra revenue used and lessen the usage of the revenue on the matters which are not in the cycle of the budget of the country. So the Budget Act is to expand through the addition of the quantitative analysis provision that will unbundle the database on one and one policy employees and simplify the path of the reports from all the sectors involved up to the National Treasury. Now, the administrative sector, in terms of this point, is the one with the highest malpracticing on the revenue activities. Thus, the provision of the quantitative regulations of the Administrative Act must be generated that will enforce the work from the level of the institution to reflect with the relevant detailed documents up to the National Treasury. Meaning transparency will be upheld. The National Treasury will now see information that she or he was not seeing before, and that promotes the payment to be done on accurate database to the correct person at the right time, on the right time, because the financial documents will always correspond with the database of payee if that system is going to be followed. And that will promote the files where they are, will promote the files of the workers to be kept with dignity and be created all the time where they are needed. For an example, my file of, is an experience that I have contacted with. For an example, my file of pension funds and retirement was created by DEPF staff in 2008 when I was applying to retire. And then which means that I didn't have a file all the time since 1979 in the institutions that I have worked on. And I didn't know that the DPEF, the file of pension fund, has to be there. There are so many files at work which a worker is supposed to know, like a financial file, personal file. Those things are not known by the worker. And it's important that transparency must be there on the systems. They must be designed and transform all the sections, the transaction part of the institution. And this model, again, will promote a decency in relation to empowering the employees about all the files captured on their behalf that I have mentioned. And then the tip number two is development plan on revenue. The physical contribution must be targeted on the area that enabling repeated payouts uncontrollably, like in the sector of housing. Also here, this model can lift up the collection of funds and diminish the deficit action by stopping one item to be financed more than once. If the data is captured from the beginning of the application with all the profile of the applicant, payments and balances, the benefits therein will be paid by force. Then the Treasury or Department of Finance can be able to recognize the extra or unwanted funds that require to be paid. If one house is to be paid for the second time, will be questioned through the indicator, why must be paid for the second time? That is the system that is supposed to be to do that. The national treasurer will not pay a house for the seven times in one house, I don't know, with different names, but it is paid by one people. Until today, I'm still paying that house. That's why I'm saying it's through the experience that I've gone through. So if one house is to be paid, okay, for the second time, okay. Hence, the strictness of the system shift in terms of responsibility from the traditional administration operations are required. So as to drive the work towards the lowering of the target percentage of the deficit performance, which was mentioned by the treasurer. That is why I'm saying my tips are based on the budget of the minister. The deficit performance, I think it must be more if it lowers the payments of the country to the debts. That's what I mean here. Or from the targeted percentage, which is based on the deficit, it should be lower. If we, all the country, can have this system, as I've said, it is designed so that the national treasurer at the upward bottom, at the upward position, should see the register. When one register a house for the first time, it must reflect on that level and all the levels with all the people. I think that is clear. Tip 3, it is macroeconomic approach. If the transferred surplus is reflected with the correlated expanded information as we have proposed, this structural principle will assist the receiver to submit the financial information like balance sheet with no hassles, since everybody dot of the data required will be noted. Accuracy of the information will speed up the process of acceptance. The expansion of the duty in this regard be seen simplifying the investigation if it is necessary, and micrography be subject to be used by everybody. Everybody can have that knowledge. If we expand the information, we expand the work that we are doing, transfer all the responsibility to the right channel, which will make us to collect the info, the money which is paid to myself seven times instead of another person, doesn't get a better life. And secondly, the macroeconomic structure reform, which showing a shift in the growth policy, is affected by the cost-saving initiatives. Just like the workshops that are to place the employee on board with the knowledge of their files of employment is of paramount importance, because you know all your files, because if you know all your files, it will encourage you not to forfeit your earnings, and that will save the funds that might be used somewhere and for nothing. In conclusion, analysis in the form of dot by dot and performance by all levels promote good work and transparency. That is all that I have. It was just the short tips that I prepared.
And thank you very much.
Okay.
I wish more members of the public would attend our meetings and can make submissions.
Okay.
So thank you for taking that lead. Honorable Karim?
Just one other thing I forgot to mention. The Finance and Fiscal Commission normally presents to the hearings. There was some confusion between the secretaries and them about times and so on. I did speak to the acting chairperson of the FSC. They'll be here on Friday morning. The other thing, just to ask these secretaries to be alert to, obviously the FSC is a different category.
Yeah.
So we can't give them the same amount of time we give NGOs and individuals who make submissions. So they also raise this issue, and I think we discussed this before, Alan. You know, company chair, we should give them more time. So if we give 20 minutes to others, we can give them 40 minutes if they want.
Yes.
Okay, because they're FSC. But they'll be on Friday morning. Okay, over to you, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. We recognize the presence of Honorable Tobias, Honorable Mabi, and Honorable Motla Shuping.
I did tender your apology.
Yeah.
I did tender apology.
But we acknowledge your presence as well. So thank you very much. Also, the National Treasury that's represented here and the PBO. The other members of our committee is with the Standing and Select Committee of Appropriations, also engaging on the MTPBS, but on the appropriation side. That's why our committee has been split.
We don't know why the group
split
on our side was late, but we will explain.
You're welcome, Honorable Mami. Honourable members, there was a presentation. Kursatu, Matthew, you mentioned something about the district councils. I want you to elaborate on that. I think it's about the funding, but what are your views on that, or Kursatu's views? And then you mentioned areas in Cape Town without water. Write it down for me and give it to me. Why? The Select Committee for Finance and Appropriations will be doing a oversight visit in the metro of Cape Town beginning of 2017. So I want that information as well. Desalinization of water, yes. There's a water desalinization plant at Sedgefield. One is being established in Port Nolloth. That's where I live. On the same basis as Swakopmund and Ludrats. So it can be done, and it was also mentioned in the minister's speech. Yes. Limpopo, rural development. We had an intervention in Limpopo since 2011, the 12th of December, up till March this year, when the intervention section 100 was terminated. In five provincial departments, where health was one of the departments. Zulani, where's Zulani? Nosipo, I think you must give that report to Russell, that he can read it, what happened there. The intervention by the national executive through the national departments, including National Treasury. We will call Limpopo, if not this year, beginning next year, just to measure the progress, the post-intervention. Russell, then you are welcome to attend that as well. Questions? So, thank you. Let's start today from that side. Number one, number two. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me take this opportunity to welcome the presentations and also try to remind myself just to confirm that we are here for public hearing on medium-term budget policy statement, which was presented. And I'll start with the presentation by Kursatu. I think there are things that you appreciate on the policy statement by the minister. But firstly, Chair, let me check I would also want to know if there were interactions with the Treasury, and also to check if Treasury is present in this meeting. Oh, okay. I used to them sitting that side, so they're hiding. I was just concerned because most of the things that are raised here, they need to
hear. They will also reply on Friday regarding inputs made.
Thank you, yeah. Chair. Thank you. Chair, on the issue of VAT and income tax increases, I think COSATU has raised some concern. And I think I will appreciate if you don't just leave it there. Raise concern, but propose something. What are you saying as COSATU? Because if you raise concern and you don't say anything, propose an alternative. How do you think we can resolve the problem? Because we have a challenge. We have to do something. But you are just raising those things as a concern. You also, Chair, the comrade there, when he made a presentation, he spoke of cracking a whip on local government and provincial, you know, departments in as far as expenditure, the pattern of expenditure, spending money on T-shirts that are not locally manufactured. And I want the comrade to go back and think of this. I'm not talking on behalf of Treasury, but I'm also talking as a child to that home, because that's my home. That let's just go and check. Buying of T-shirts versus expenditure on service delivery. Which one is the priority? Because as much as we want to promote and support local business, but we must also not encourage, you know, those activities while we talk of cost curtailment. I think we need to encourage expenditure on service delivery issues that is going to benefit the communities. On the wasteful expenditure, cutbacks, the bling expenditure, consultants, we agree on the consultants, we agree on most of the issues that you're raising here, the labor brokers issues, more especially the outsourcing. But I'm just thinking that most of the things that my comrade have raised here, we need to help to say they need to be directed to the relevant platforms where they can be raised, because I think it is good that they have raised these things, we are aware of them, but I don't think they raise things just to raise them. They need a resolution at the end of the day. They need to be resolved, they need to be attended to. And I think as a committee in Parliament, we need to be that helpful hand. I think the issue of the wasteful expenditure and fruitless expenditure and all those things, we have been hard on them as Parliament, in support with the AG. We are totally not agreeing with those things. So we are together on those issues. Also on corruption, we can't agree on that with whoever is doing it, but we agree with you. Chairperson, issues on vacancies. Under health, they've raised vacancies, and I think the presenter also from what rural health, he also raised the issue of vacancies, the moratoriums. And you gave an example about Mpumalanga, to be specific on education. And we are saying as an oversight body, we also understand with our experience and with all the information that we have as people who are within the community. You cannot give good service delivery in health without personnel, because that's the kind of service that is personal, is human driven. You cannot give a good service in education if you are running short of teachers. We agree on that. And I think the relevant, you know, unions like SADU in Mpumalanga, they had a march about that, gave a memorandum to the MEC. She's attending to that. But also, Che, most of the issues that COSATU have raised here, and also coupled with what the Rural Health Forum has raised, I think they need to, they are more of, not everything, but most of the things, they are more operational, which I think can be resolved at different forums. We have bargaining chambers at the level of a province where you can take these issues and deal with the direct people, the provincial department, who can take decisions, make them to take decisions. These are the things that through your structures you must put in the agenda of the bargaining chambers. At the national level, if they cannot be resolved there, you have a bargaining council. You can take these things there. Those are the people who can make them to take resolutions, and those resolutions are going to be binding. Unlike us as finance committee, we can help, but we cannot take decisions on operational issues. You know, management styles that are there at a face value. So I'm requesting that you need to strengthen your organization, more especially to COSATU. You appear in all these structures that I have mentioned. You have a rural health. I hope you are working with RUDASA, Rural Doctors Association. I hope you also work with DINOSA, you work with PSA, you work with NEHAU, you work with SAMA, South African Medical Association. Because if you are united with those organized bodies, you will be able to resolve these issues, and you will be able to reach, you know, the correct people and talk to the correct people. I think also to Umamala. So, Chairperson, I'm saying, in as much as we cannot resolve or talk much on operational issues, but we can give advice, because of course some of us who have been there, we know what best we can do. And I think these issues, they raise them here because they feel they are important, and they might have not been given an opportunity to be listened to, or they might have been listened to but nothing happened. So it's important that you come and you also talk about them. The country here, what you are, you're talking. The CWP, on the slide that you talk about, COCTA and Public Works, CWP, EPWP, I have been there, but I agree with you. This is not assisting. And I think as Parliament, we need to take a posture to help government to get this program to be organized. Because the way it is, it can be easily abused, but also to raise hopes. I understand, you know, the motive behind this and the policy behind it, but it's also important that as legislators, we raise dissatisfaction about it and agree with COSATU. Not that I'm becoming too excited because my home is here, but reality is reality. Karim Uyangizoms. I'm Shai Stamtu. I'm talking really it. But he's too serious. I don't think he hears me. He's too serious. It's unlike him. So, Chairperson, I think I've raised and summarized most of the issues on the presentation by COSATU. On the public enterprise issue, last year when we met with SAA, not this year, last year, our first meeting, we have raised issues, and one of the issues that we have raised, one of the questions that I raised is about job losses. But when you talk about integration and when you talk about restructuring, obviously there will be casualties. And I think as smart as I know you to be, COSATU, you might have calculated this because there will be casualties if you integrate. But I have not done my homework on this. I just hearing it for the first time. I'm just using my layman knowledge to say once you come with restructuring, you must expect such things. And I know that your interest is to protect the interests of the workers and the jobs. So in terms of the integration, I'm not sure, Chairperson. But I agree with you on other issues that you have raised here. But when I look at, in summary, all your issues that you have raised, you have some recommendations, even if you have not organized your recommendations as recommendations alone, but you could pick them up as you present. We could pick them up as you raise. To a certain extent, I think you are recommending or you see a need for more funding. And from the experience that I have, when you make a demand that you need so many percent at a workplace as a worker, as COSATU for that matter, already you know, you have made your own homework, you know they can afford. But I want to believe that you have done your homework as I know you, based on the situation that you are facing. And the minister, when he made a statement, we had pressure on higher education, we had discussions on the TVET and all those things. And everybody else thinks they need more. But I think you need to help us to prioritize. Because we can't afford to do everything at the same time and please everybody. So you as an organized body, you need to do your homework and help. Because it's not helping to just demand and demand and demand and demand and raise expectations. Demand with a bucket of suggestions. To say this is the roadmap that I think you can take. Depending on that will help. But also, I'm still emphasizing, comrade, let's go to the bargaining councils. Let our shop steward work. Let them engage. You know, on these issues of management, when I look at this presentation of rural health advocacy project, you are raising issues of management styles. There are no pages. I wanted to refer to pages so that you know what I'm talking about. But on the slide that talks to cost containment to the health system, diminished capacity of staff to deliver services, poor supervision of junior staff, and medical errors. To me, Chair, this is operational. And there's nothing that we can do about the supervision of junior staff as the finance committee at this level.
The only thing that I think we can do is to advise, to say, make sure you work together with these bodies that I have mentioned before. Go to the relevant structures, go to the relevant authority. Maybe Chairperson also to go to the relevant portfolio committees, so that they can raise these issues, and those portfolio committees can engage with provinces. You know, for an example, if you present these issues to health, maybe, then health can be able to engage with relevant provinces on the matters. But the easiest way, I think, to deal with this is to engage those departments, because these are more operational than anything else. I think I've addressed the issue of the post, the accruals, bailouts, critical posts, and all those. The recommendations, Chair, there's a slide, the first slide that speaks to recommendation is written the goal, an approach to critical posts should be 1, 2, and 3. And I think if you can work together with those bodies and refer it to relevant structures, use those bargaining chambers and bargaining councils. I know they are sectoral, some health and education for COSATU, but I think that's where you'll get a resolution, unless they say, or you realize there's a problem in as far as funding is concerned, then, and that funding is a problem of national. You are the relevant people to help departments or provinces to prioritize. Because when you talk about cost curtailment, you gave a good example. How does it help to have doctors and nurses, you know, health professionals, but you don't have cleaners? So they complement each other. So it's only you who can guide and advise those provinces in as far as prioritization is concerned. Thank you very much, Chairperson. And I think the last presentation, Chair, I think GEPA and GEPF needs to come to the party, and we need to find a way of assisting such organizations so that space can be opened and let them talk about these things. And it's like she was there, or she might have heard what we have raised when we met them, to say there are those people who come from homeland, who are from the previous homeland system, and they are caught in between, or they got lost, you know, in the process. So they need to be heard. Thank you, Chair.
Before Mr. Mania comes in, just to inform the new Michael Sachs, that what normally happens is, although you reply on a subsequent day, in this case it happens to be Friday, to what the stakeholders say, we normally give you 5 to 10 minutes just to give a response, because they're here today. You can't expect them to fly in on Friday if they're outside Cape Town. So you have to give a brief response at the end, just to alert you on that, right? Thank you.
David?
Thank you, Chair. Let me demonstrate to the Honourable Member how to ask a question. I've to COSATU.
Which member are you referring to, David?
I think that's outrageous, really. It's uncalled for, it's again disdainful.
David?
You know, if Colin Eglin said it with the wit and charm that he had, or René Italia to repeat to Denise, being smart, it's different. You have a particular meaning to this committee, right? As a racial polarizer is how I put you. You treat people with disdain, actually, and contempt. And we're not going to have this, David. I think it's outrageous. I can't rule that you must withdraw it, I don't know. But it's really unnecessary that the contempt of the tone, not just the words. If somebody else said it with a certain elegance and charm, that's different, and a wit, which you don't have, actually. Right? And you can't decide.
And David, you are pressing the wrong button.
Actually, Dickie Levy hardly ever speaks. So if
I tell you, you are pressing a wrong button, and I'm not going to tolerate you.
That's right. And you know what? If you put
I
the 2 years...
I hope you stand for what you're standing.
Yeah, 2.5 years...
Don't even go there.
Yeah. You've been provoked.
Don't.
I call on members, please, to respect each other. We've got people here from society. Yes. Yes. Mr. May, Honourable Mania, I
Chair,
think you must be very careful about
button,
what you
she
say.
She obviously is pressing my button. So perhaps it's something we should talk about afterwards. Let me put my question. I'd like to put my questions to Kasatu. The first question is, you did traverse the issue of VAT. Could you just be clear? Are there any circumstances under which you would support an increase in VAT, or are you firmly opposed to using VAT to raise revenue? That's the first question. Second question is, you mentioned NEDLAC. Are you, where does Kasatu stand on the proposed secret strike ballot? Thank you.
Any other questions? None?
I'd like to ask.
Honourable Karim.
Sorry, Chairperson.
Honourable Karim.
Okay.
No, you can go ahead. You want?
No, I'm just asking to correct the lady there with the GEP institution. What I'm sure they're saying it was too short. I want to clarify that the GEPF did the correct thing by starting the file. The file was supposed to be there from the institution. The institutions down there, like Helbro, those are the people who are not creating a clear atmosphere to the employees by not transparently giving them the correct files. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarity.
On that note, I think what we can do, Mrs. Nemanja, is to meet with Antonio's there, the committee secretary, Zolani and Alan, and whoever else is here. Tebo was on sick leave, I think, is that right? And Michael Sachs, can you deal with this matter after this meeting? Right? On behalf of Treasury, your concerns about that. Secondly, I think one of the things that's very striking, Comrade Chair, is that this is a very empty room, as it were, if you look on this side. And yet we are experiencing the most challenging economic difficulties and social and political ever since 1994. Now, I don't know what the committee secretaries can do. They do their job. But we have to ask, why is it that people are not coming here? Even the 6 or 7 submissions originally made for oral presentation here, all of them frittered away yesterday afternoon. And it's not as if it's the 2nd of October, November protest marches in Swane. I don't think so, from what I gathered from Alan. One or two of them may be affected by that. But it is very worrying, actually. This is the medium-term budget policy statement. It sets the framework for the budget for the next 3 years. I don't know what we do. Now, you asked rural health to come. Frankly, Parliament should pay for that. We used to do it before. So I think in our report, my friend Esther and I was teasing Esther yesterday before she gets misunderstood. And it's good that she stands up for what she believes. You know, whether the chairs agree with her or not, that's the way you should be. You're not servile or docile to us. I mean, you just do your job. She has some strong views, and it's very good. We like that. So, you know, yesterday, in case you misunderstand, I was just teasing Esther. But what I want to say is I think we should put something in our report. I don't know what we do. But you see, you can't expect the secretaries to actually do things that are undermined by the way we function in this parliament. In other words, credibility is at issue. What is this about? It's about our credibility as parliament. People do not take us seriously enough. I remember walking past this place, man. You know, Comrade Chair, you would find this hall full. Matthew was still in his nappies then. This hall used to be full when we had budgets. So really, this is very worrying, really. And I don't think we should ignore what's going on here. Secondly, you know where my political heart is, right, and my mind. But you know something? I mean, a lot of what Dick Aledi, your former trade union comrade, says is correct. I just want to say, Comrade Matthew, what you're giving us is a series of objectives, goals, directors. You're covering issues that you've covered before in different forms that most of us in this committee will agree with. Now, I know Naledi, your research institute, is very challenged, which symptomizes COSATU where it is at the moment, right? But, you know, we're pleading with you, Matthew. You're very sophisticated. You work hard. What you're giving us is really not commensurate what COSATU should be giving us. You're even telling us how you want us to deal with these things. For example, it seems reasonable to suggest that one possibility over the next period, year or two, is a possible VAT increase. I'm not saying that's the view of the minister or the ministry. I'm seeing Tandi is walking in right now. I'm just saying a possible option for Treasury is some measured VAT increase. We don't know. Now, can you do some work in that area and submit it to us by, let's say, early January? You know, what are your views on VAT? Submit it to the National Treasury. What we would like, I want to say this yesterday, where's the Parliamentary Budget Office? Who's here from the PBO? Yeah. Rashad, I think the two chairs, man, if the committee members disagree, they can raise the issue. I think you should start working on VAT. What are the strengths and weaknesses? I think you've done some work in, I see Gloria's here. She's so tiny, she's hidden there, but Gloria is more with us, right? In other words, let's not, Rashad, you can play some role. Gloria, you are allocated here. You're the successor to Dumasani, right? Tandi, I see your hand, but I would like to speak. I mean, Dick Lady spoke for 4.5 hours. I'd like to speak for 2.5. So what I'm saying is, you know, no, Tandi, you speak for 10 hours. So really, you come last. So when I'm about to leave the room for a chairperson's committee meeting at 12:30, can I just raise this thing? PBO, can you do some work on VAT? You can do whatever you want, but one guide from the majority party is, can you look into VAT in general, but can you specifically give us ways that the VAT can be introduced without disadvantaging disproportionately the poor? It's the sort of thing that you raised before, that people don't actually zero rate in practice. Is that right? That's what you say, Matthew? Basic foodstuffs. How is it done elsewhere in the world, in countries where there's extreme inequality? Namibia is 16%, I'm told, eh? And many countries in the developing world are 18%, India and so on. I don't know. So can you do some work now, Gloria? Right? Start moving on it. Let's have a first draft by early January. Okay? Then the next thing I want to raise is your stuff is too descriptive, really. I think you know what I'm saying. Look, it's not a criticism of you. Your Naledi is a shadow of what it was, right? Then on retirement reform, look, let me put this on record for Esther and so on when you do the draft of the report. We have written to the two ministers concerned. We have sent the letters to COSATU and other stakeholders. I think you sent it, Alan, to everybody, right? I have spoken to the leader of government business. Outside this meeting, the political party concerned has been asked to intervene. I don't know what more we can do, right? So really, this parliament must now flex its muscle. The minister has to give his first formal report, I think, on the 15th of December. Am I right, Alan? 15th of December in terms of the act. Right? Now, I think we must put some pressure now. You know, the MTBPS is over. So can we say that the chairpersons are mandated to take further steps, further appropriate steps? Esther, you're writing all this down, eh? Further appropriate steps to insist that the matter be addressed. On COSATU's side, you must flex your muscle. The parliament can do what it wants to do, but you can't come crying here. You must do what you think is appropriate. Right? The next thing is on the doctor's issue. I think that's covered a lot. Michael Sachs, would like you to respond immediately. On higher education, what exactly is COSATU's view, if you have a precise one? Are you talking about free education for all? Do you think that's not regressive? And if so, why? There's a lot of issues I'll drop. The labor inspectors issue, I think many of us will be sympathetic, Michael Sachs, so perhaps you can give us an idea of what is going on there. On the shareholder management bill, we've raised this repeatedly. Let's stress it again. I gather from today's business day that the minister, Lynn Brown, is taking key aspects of a shareholder management bill to cabinet next Wednesday. Do you know what's going on there, Mr. Sachs? And can you tell us? Mrs. Nyamani can go and speak with... can you, Antonio, just pin down Mrs. Nyamani and just get the key points of what she's saying or the written text? We must cover it in the report. On rural health, can you reply to that, Michael Sachs? I mean, obviously, the way they're presenting it seems credible to us, but they may be very... I don't think you're any different from him in your values. So why are you doing what he says you're doing? That's why I call you the new Michael Sachs, at least the old Michael Sachs. So listen, tell us, what's the problem, really? There's a whole lot of other inane questions I've got to ask, but I don't think I'll ask them. When we do the report, we will confer with Treasury around that. Thank you.
Honourable Tobias.
Thank you very much, Chair. First, let me apologize for my outburst. I'm starting to take serious exception of David Mina's behavior. At one point, we'll want us to rediscuss this matter again. But let me go to the input, and I might have captured it in the middle from COSAT. But to me, the manner in which the presentation has been made, to me, Chair, it's a problem statement. I will suggest that we give COSATU an opportunity to give us a document that will make suggestions. For instance, when I entered here, you spoke to the issue of the type of taxation that needs to be imposed to increase our revenue collection. So I will want COSATU to make a presentation of scenarios so that we can engage with it. Because as it stands, it's just a problem statement. It doesn't necessarily provide the type of input that we'll expect. Some issues, I will not go to them because they're not new. Secondly, I will want COSAT to also give a proposal on the sugar tax and we engage with that. Secondly, the issue of the wage bill. The minister has demonstrated why there's a need to cut funding of vacant posts. I want to see what other alternatives will cause her to make a presentation so that we can engage with that. In terms of dividends and reinvestments, we have what we call the SIPs in government. For instance, there was this 7 SIPs that government has presented, and one of them, which was the SIP that I took serious, was the investment on renewable energy. So if there's a different reinvestment suggestions, can we also look at that and we engage with that when that. Can we also suggest, Chair, if possible, consultant to make a presentation to us on their suggestion on the comprehensive social security. Do they have a paper? If there is any from COSATU, can we see it so that we can engage it? Because I know the department is working on something. Mike will be able to respond to that maybe when he's giving us a briefing. On NAFSAS, I hope... Maybe we have looked at the proposals that National Treasury has made. Can we also have their own figures that they want us to consider? I know I'm taking us a back check because I don't know when I'm going to do it, but I want us to engage with figures so that we can compare as to what the minister has presented, because if we don't have such, then we will not be able to effectively look at alternative proposals on the table. On the TVET colleges, it's a matter that has been discussed, but we want also to have COSATU strategy on ensuring that the quality of education that the lecturers at TVET colleges are providing speaks to the outcomes that want to be achieved. So maybe we'll want to see how they have dealt with teacher training at the level of COSATU. So we'll also look into that. So sorry, Chair, for taking a little bit too long. I've spoken to the renewable energy SIPs that spoke about a mere investment. So I think this matter shouldn't be appearing here because we've already dealt with it. So I then suggest after that we'll be able to make inputs having considered those documents. I'm sorry if you can't hear me, Chair. I need to take a breath. I've got a condition when I get that much disturbed. I need to take a break.
You done?
Yeah.
The sound's not very good. That's why I'm trying my best to concentrate on what members are saying. Kusato, most of the questions are directed to you, then Russell. Anyone else? Questions? You may reply. Sorry, I didn't see it. You must have rupa, you may prat.
Chairperson, thank you. Mine is not a question. I just want to touch on something that you raised already. I have a little bit of a concern with, you know, really the public participation that we have, and you touched on that. And maybe, you know, we should be looking into that. How can we maybe bring in more participation, you know, while Kusatu is a serious participant, and even people like the lady and so on. We need to have meaningful participation if we want to get somewhere. Thank you, sir.
Noted. Kusatu?
Thanks, Chair. Maybe just to touch on the last issue that members have raised on public participation with a few of our own experiences. Look, often it's difficult because different committees have different approaches to it. Some committees, like this committee, will advertise it in the city press. You can see it there. If you go to the parliamentary website, most of the time, most committee adverts are not featured on the parliamentary website. You'll struggle to find it. In fact, Chair, to be honest, the PMG website is more useful to know what's happening in Parliament. You'll find much more around public comment issues from departments and from Parliament on the PMG website. It's updated daily. The parliamentary website, to be honest, if I can be blunt, Chair, isn't helpful. Because at times you would even hear by the wayside that a committee is having a public hearing. It wasn't advertised in the newspapers. It's not on the website of Parliament. But it was advertised on Radio Tobela or something. That was difficult because now there's no standard process around it. I think the other issue, Chair, is that, you know, my colleagues in the provinces normally swear at me and they ignore my emails if I tell them about parliamentary hearings in the provinces. Because they're mobilized for a hearing in the Free State the day before the committee cancels it. Yet comrades have gone out to mobilize, inform workers, inform the public, inform NGOs, and then it's changed the last second because of there's an urgent debate in Parliament or whatever the normal issue is. That's my own truth, sense of thought, Chair. Look, let me just sort of run through the issues quickly. I must say, Chair, look, previously we used to give very long submissions to Parliament, and the MPs would complain that our submissions are too long. We would come with a 25-page submission for a 5-page bill. And then you will see that we're losing members because we're talking too much detail. But we can gladly do it. Chair, in terms of our...
Not about the number of pages. You can write it in 4 pages, the quality of what you give us. I mean, Matthew, you know that fully well.
Look, Chair, we've made proposals around income tax increases to the Judge Davis Tax Commission. We can gladly share that. We can even do that this week. We've got all those details there, so it's easy to do.
Can we share that this afternoon? Today's Wednesday.
No, we've done it already. We did it last year at the Judge Davis Commission. We can gladly share it. Obviously, the Judge Davis Commission is covering a wide variety of tax increases. Look, Chair, I'll just run through the issues quickly. The reason why we had raised the issue of renewable energy was basically just to highlight a successful government program, which I think needs to be built upon. But again, Chair, to raise our concerns around nuclear energy, which I feel is not affordable, and from our feeling, we get different messages from different departments in government. Chair, look, we have had interactions with Treasury at NEDLAC, I think more than previously, and I think at our last meeting about 2 weeks ago with Michael and other colleagues, we felt there's a need to increase that. And I think Chair would want to even do even more than that, willing to sit with government to say where can we cut expenditure, where can we reprioritize from our point of view, where we think we can come with tax increases, proposals and so on. Our position around VAT is that, look, it hits the poor the hardest, but we do think that on luxury goods you can increase taxes. You can increase taxes also around imports, especially non-essential imports, which also have the added benefit of encouraging domestic production and so on. Chair, our concern around the issue of income tax is that, again, you hit the working class and middle classes more. But again, look, we're not saying everybody must be treated the same. We think around the rich, you can increase income taxes, the space. Again, the same thing with around company taxes. We think those companies which are performing well, which have sufficient income, you can increase. I think, Chair, why we also mentioned the issue of dividends and reinvestment also as well, to give proposals, as members are saying, how can we use those taxes to incentivize businesses to invest locally, to procure locally, and so on. Chair, I know Honourable Magadze raised that we are raising some of the bargaining council issues here, and that is true. But also, look, partly it's because Parliament holds government accountable across all its fields, so we know you deal specifically one department, for example. I think also to bring members into the picture on our members' concerns. But I think, Chair, also that at times our members receive an intransigent response from certain provincial departments, which then forces, like in Mpumalanga, that SATU went on strike or march around cutting 1,400 teaching posts. So I think that's part of it, because at times provincial departments simply don't want to engage. Chair, also we're not saying that we support buying of T-shirts to Honourable Magadze, or catering, or this expensive approach to public consultation. We think you must cut, but when our point is that when departments or municipalities procure, it must be local procurement, because we're talking about keeping money locally, about boosting local capacity, assisting small businesses, local industries, etc. And again, Chair, we've got many ideas around cutting unreasonable expenditure. So we've mentioned some here, but we'd also mention some if we meet with Treasury. I think, Chair, we must commend government around the massive reduction around reducing expenditure on consultants. There's a huge change in the past few years. And I think also there's a massive improvement around reducing rollover expenditure. I think about 3-4 years ago, there was a huge problem where literally billions and billions was rolled over. We've seen a massive improvement in this regard. Chair, yes, we're glad that the Honourable Magadze around the issue of the expanded public works programs. And look, Chair, we're not dogmatic. We sympathize with government being desperate to create jobs, especially for low-skilled, long-term unemployed people, and for whom the public works programs often the only option for getting some sort of income. But our concern, Chair, is that because municipalities lack a sufficient tax base often, this becomes a way of balancing the books. So that's the one point. But also, Chair, you know, it's quite worrying if you see a well-resourced municipality like, sorry to pick on the city of Cape Town, but just because we live here, if they're using EPWP for cleaning of municipal buildings or to hire metro police to go and raid gang houses or arrest gangsters, that's quite worrying, because that should be a permanent function of government. And if we're going to find a way of creating a supply of cheap labor, it becomes quite a worrying thing. But look, Chair, we had meetings with the Public Works Department on it, including the Deputy Minister of Public Works and COGTA. There was an agreement to change the terms of reference and to scrutinize these issues. But at times, to be honest with you, Chair, we raise issues on a daily basis with different departments of government. And at times, government moves very slowly. It takes years for them to respond. And often if they respond, it's a bureaucratic managing of a way of issues. Chair, in terms of public enterprises and SAA, look, our position is that clearly the current status is not sustainable to have 3.5 public airlines. And our thing is that we must rather work now proactively to deal with the issue to avoid a situation of losing jobs. Because if government's forced to bail out SAA for the tune of, I think it's 4.5 billion rand every year, clearly one day government is going to get fed up and just start privatizing. We want to avoid that crisis scenario. So our position then is, let's consolidate, let's save jobs. Through attrition, you can, for example, deal with those kind of surplus jobs if you consolidate. But also, Chair, I think there's been numerous examples in the media about wasteful expenditure or even corruption in some of the parastatals, which, again, if we deal with it properly, we can avoid that kind of a nightmare scenario. But, Chair, I think our position to Honourable Magadzi is that let's be proactive and deal with issues now before we get to a crisis stage. I think Deputy Minister Jonas said it nicely. We'd rather do stuff now than wait for the IMF to come and be brutal, and they won't be sympathetic to our positions. Chair, I'm just trying to, and a lot of the issues overlap, so I'm just trying to consolidate them. Chair, look, we can give you the issues of informal areas which are not receiving water or decent sanitation, electricity. We can gladly do that. In terms of the district councils and local municipalities, Chair, look, I think we can see with many municipalities, I think there's the issue of Tabazimbi, where the furniture was confiscated by the sheriffs. And there's many other municipalities, I think Zanin, there's also some in the Klein-Karoo in the Western Cape, where municipalities are basically bankrupt. And that clearly shows there's not a sufficient rates base. And hence, can we really afford to have both districts and local municipalities? Perhaps we should not be looking at revisiting our model. What's a financially sustainable model? Look, obviously, we need to do it properly, timelessly, to avoid the whole Vuani nightmare that we experienced previously. Chair, again, around the issue of desalination, and we're glad that you have raised some of the examples, our plea for government would be, let's adopt the ESCOM war room scenario approach to water and desalination, because clearly it's a ticking time bomb for many areas, including in your rural constituency. I think that's basically the issues we'd want to raise, Chair. I think maybe the last issues around the wage bill and expenditure. Look, I think government also leadership needs to lead by example. If we're asking to reduce public service posts, we can also send a political message by reducing cabinet posts, by reducing provincial cabinet posts, by reducing mayoral committee posts. It's difficult to expect SATU to agree to tightening the belt, but yet we have 35 ministers, 36 deputy ministers, 90 MECs. But look, I want to give one good example, Comrade Chair, because we often poke at Treasury. The Minister of Finance purchased a modest car. I think it's about 500,000 rand. We don't see that example being followed by our good colleagues in other cabinets. And in fact, one heard a worrying report last week in the Northern Cape that an MEC bought a new VW Touareg. 3 months later, she asked for it to be replaced by a new Mercedes-Benz, which was more befitting her stature. So those are the kind of worrying political messages, Chair. Yeah, hopefully I've addressed the questions, Chair. Thanks very much.
Russell?
Sorry, Chair. Northern Cape. I'm just abusing the Chair because I know he's from the Northern Cape.
In my constituency, I've got 78 kilometers of tar road and 650 kilometers of gravel road. Yes. Let's not go into that debate.
Okay.
You want to have a follow-up? Quick one. Because Russell must get...
Thank you. I asked a question about Kasati's position on the secret structure.
Matthew?
Sorry, Chair, yeah. I was hoping to escape that difficult one. On a more serious note, Chair, look, the labour market stability negotiations in NEDLAC have been going fairly well. We're hopefully going to conclude by end of this year. Look, workers don't benefit from going on long strikes because workers don't get paid. And then obviously the company's put in a difficult scenario. But I think politically, Chair, look, the strike is the worker's only way of forcing an engagement. It is only his or her only tool of pressurizing bosses. Normally workers are forced to go on strike because the bosses have been intransigent and refuse to engage, or workers are very desperate because of the bad conditions. I must say the strike ballot, it might sound good on paper because it's democratic, etc. Some of our strike ballots are part of the policies and the practices for many years. Others don't have it. Sometimes, for example, SACAO, which organizes in the retail sector, it's very difficult for them because the members are spread over a huge
variety of workplaces, often 5 workers here, 10 workers here. So to conduct that logistically becomes a huge nightmare, and then you lose the momentum and so on. I think the other concern is that we're worried about a position where if you say, like, you must have a strike ballot, then you must obviously have technical requirements for what constitutes a legitimate ballot. Is there a voter's role? How was it conducted? Who observed it? Was it a show of hands, secret ballot? Now, the experience of some unions before this was there during the party era is that bosses then find it a loophole to say, no, the strike ballot wasn't conducted properly, therefore the strike must be cancelled. They go to court, get an interdict, then they collapse workers' sole tool of negotiating. So those are the kind of the context to it. But look, the negotiation isn't complete yet. There's been compromises on all sides, and we're hopeful it'll be a fairly decent compromise at the end of the day, as part of our contribution, Chair. Thanks.
Russell?
Thank you, Chair. I think just in response, yes, a lot of the issues that we raised do occur on an operational level. But I think the point that we're trying to make is that, you know, form follows function. And we feel that due to the lack of clarity from national, right, that informs action both at a provincial and district level, we felt we needed to make a case what's the impact of not better articulating what is a critical post. If an administrator reads, okay, only doctors and nurses are critical posts, those are the only posts we're going to protect, and we're going to sort of just blind ourselves to all the others. And it's not just about one province. We live across 9 different provinces, different levels of skills, different levels of capacity. And sometimes it's just system inertia. So for us, the key point is, A, we want the National Treasury and the National Department of Health to sort of reflect on you know, one of the things that we meant to do are social impact assessments on any bills and stuff that we introduce. And I think maybe this is also an opportunity for us to look at a social impact assessment of a cost containment measure. You know, what are the unintended consequences of introducing not like a nebulous cost containment measure without giving specific details? Because sometimes, you know, there's a lot of blood on the dance floor because we miss opportunities. But I recognize that we work with our professional bodies. In fact, RUDASA is a constituent member or founding partner of the Rural Health Advocacy Project, as is Section 27, formerly the AIDS Law Project, the VIT Center for Rural Health, the Rural Nurses Association, the Junior Doctors Association. We do have regular engagement with other professional bodies within the medical industry. But I think our time here today was to say that we are looking at a crisis in healthcare. And unless we can sort of work together collectively to figure out how we're going to manage ourselves out of this crisis, we might pay much, much more than what we're saving now in the near term. That's our position. I think that's why we take it on a national level. But yes, we do engage with the provinces and with the employer bodies specifically. And I think, secondly, something that we feel maybe is not being addressed by the committee or haven't had any questions or comments is around the issue of the equitable share. Right? And the Minister says that this is an area that we're going to be investigating heavily, and the Fiscal and Finance Commission will also be looking at this. But it has the potential to have a significant impact. I mean, as you know, currently under health, there's no we have conditional grants for health infrastructure, we have conditional grants for HIV and AIDS and TB, but we don't have any protected funding for district health services. There was a bill that was introduced in 2000, around primary health care, which was rejected by the provinces. Currently, the only form of funding that primary health care receives is through the equitable share. And as we know, the provinces also have a level of autonomy, so the allocations that are allowed for within the equitable share isn't necessarily the allocations that is received by those provincial departments of health or even those district health councils. And then second to that, you know, we also feel the issue of accruals is something that needs to be dealt with. You know, there's a number of provinces that run the rolling accruals. You know, in a sense, they're unauthorized deficits. They're not funded. And they severely impact on health service delivery. When money comes through, half of it goes back to paying off accruals. So the only measure that we have is to re-engage and roll expenses. But yes, these issues are operational issues, but they're also policy and budget issues, where I feel that the Standing Committee on Finance can have some input in providing direction to both national government as well as provincial treasuries as they dispense their mandate of delivering better health for all.
On the 10th of November, it's a Thursday, the Select Committee on Appropriations will get a briefing from the National Treasury on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, which refers also to the equitable share. You're welcome to attend that meeting, and after that there will be public hearings on the Division of Revenue Bill as well in the provinces, Northern Cape, on the 17th of November, if I'm correct, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Kimberley. I noted, Honourable Tobias.
Thank you, Chair.
We must just be careful of the time. The chairs have a meeting at 12:30.
Yes, I'm not going to be long. I don't know where this matter belongs, but the issues that Russell has raised, I think, needs us to make proposals to the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and the Portfolio Committee on Health. For instance, the Minister of Finance cannot predetermine which posts should be shared in government departments. It's the purview of those departments. Here, he lays a foundation of a principle on cost-cutting measures. So he raised a fundamental question on the social impact and the unintended consequences of cost-containment measures. And he further elaborated why he believed that there need to be a reprioritization of the lower posts, not only those who are deemed as critical, which are your doctors and nurses. So it's an important matter, but it's not in the purview of the Minister of Finance to decide which posts need to be shared. So it's a matter maybe in our recommendations or with our other engagements we can then forward to those committees to take into consideration when they engage their own respective departments. Yes.
Thank you.
Chair, I think I agree with what Honourable Tobias is saying. Partly that's what I wanted to raise. But on what you say, the importance of the lower level, the lowest paid working people at the hospital, the cleaners, I think those things are covered within the 10-point plan, from the Department of Health. And as suggested by Honourable Tobias, when you meet with those departments, more especially Department of Health, you can have something to support your argument on the 10-point plan that the department has committed on. I think to a certain extent, I have been in that environment of health for a period of 3 years, to 2009 until 2011. And I have been having the same concern that you're having, that rural provinces, I don't think, the budget, they are not allocated accordingly. And I had a feeling that the focus is more on, you know, the urban provinces or cities. So I think it's what the battle that you're pushing is for a good cause and it's worth it. But let's go to the relevant, you know, structures and department and forums to raise those things. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, National Treasury. Michael? Yes?
I'm sorry to sort of just interject and to really push this issue. Unfortunately, the issues of finance and service delivery overlap, right? And I think it would be remiss for me to say that this is just purely a health issue, right? Policy guidance on spending comes from finance, right? Provincial treasuries allocate funds, right? The only source of funding for district and primary healthcare services is through the equitable share, right? So, without guidance from, I'm not saying that the Minister of Finance has the purview of determining posts, but the Minister of Finance set out a directive that they recognize the protection of posts in education, in the SAPs, and in health, right? And I think that goes down to the change and filters through provincial and district policy implementation.
implementation. So I think we have to understand that there is a policy implementation impact in the decisions made by the Finance Committee and the Treasury at large. Yeah, and then finally, you know,
Order.
And then, thank you, Honourable Member. And then I think finally, I really want to put on record that the challenges that are being faced by district health teams in the management of their budgets, in the provincial allocations that are allowed. We know that provincial treasuries or provincial legislators have discretion in terms of how they allocate funds. Right, so there may be a directive coming down with the equitable share saying that you must spend X amount on health, X amount on social development. When the money arrives, the province has an opportunity to reallocate funding where they want to. And sometimes that could mean less funding for critical services. And health is something that doesn't change. People are still going to come. Whether you cut the funding, people are still going to come when they're sick. You know, so in a lot of our provinces, our district health services are underfunded. And this is going to create a much bigger problem further down the line. And I think what it is from us to say as the Rural Health Advocacy Project, and also I think an opportunity for finance and treasury to really help us understand and how we can work together as a social compact to fix this issue, particularly the issue around accruals. Thank you.
You are welcome to attend that public hearing when appropriations were conducted. Michael, Mr. Sachs.
Thank you, Chair. Just to maybe start there, I think as, so first of all, and maybe it relates to the participation, I think we have an ongoing discussion between Treasury and various civil society organizations, including Rural Health Advocacy Project and others on these kind of issues. And of course, the issues that are being raised are very apt and we're balancing many different things. I wanted to just start by quoting a short passage from the MCBPS, which is on page 34 of the document. We say that spending pressures are mounting across the public finances. And then we give a number of examples of these spending pressures. Firstly, the 2015 public sector wage settlement continues to limit the availability of resources for critical public services. Secondly, in the health sector, higher salaries, rising utilization of services, and higher import prices for medicines are straining budgets. Thirdly, the local equitable share, which funds free basic service delivery for electricity and water for the poor, is more thinly stretched as utility prices outpace inflation. Fourthly, as social infrastructure is extended further into rural areas, unit connection costs are rising. So the reason I'm starting there is that it's an acknowledgement of many of the problems that has been raised of the public finances are under pressure. There is much more limited growth in budget allocations, and this is having consequences. But in many cases, this is not so much a budget issue as it is a consequence of the choices that we have made. One of the choices we have made is about salaries for public servants. And I would agree with Kosatu that, you know, we shouldn't be blaming public servants for wanting higher salaries and wanting a living wage, as it's put. But on the other hand, we have to make choices. And when we make choices, we must live with the consequences. The important thing about public servant salaries, I think, is not the level of the wages. It's the relationship between the level of the wages and the performance of the public service. So this year, in 2015 or 2016, we awarded an effective 10% increase to public servants across the board. That may be welcome. Within a few months, we were facing national industrial action about annual national assessments in the basic education sector. So what I'm pointing to is the need for a national dialogue between, let's not focus on the wages, let's talk about the salaries and the performance. Over the last, in 2000, for each learner in the basic education system, we were spending 8,000 rand in 2015 prices, so I'm taking out inflation. So in 2000, we were spending 8,000 rand for each learner. Today, we spend 18,000 rand for each learner. Because of the nature, as others have pointed out, because of the nature of public services, that spending is primarily on compensation budgets. So we've massively increased our compensation budget per learner over that period, over the 15-year period. That is both an employment of greater number of teachers and an improvement in the conditions of service of teachers. But then if you ask the question, has the quality of our education improved over that period? Many people would say it has not. And that's really the question that we need to focus on. It's very true, as we point out there, that there's rising pressure on budgets, particularly rising pressure on health budgets, and as the presenter has pointed out, when we talk about the health budget, we are effectively talking about 10 different budgets, not a single budget, because health budgets are appropriated by provinces and are funded through the equitable share. So it's not even appropriated by Parliament. Parliament has some discretion over the, or discussion about the division of revenue, but once it's divided and put into the equitable share pot, it's provinces that determine how much they appropriate for health, for education, for other core services on the one hand, and then how much they appropriate for other things that they would like to do. And this is something that needs to be thought about. In general, my observation is that while pressure is rising across the system, the effectiveness of our systems is greater in the more urban developed parts of the country than it is in the rural, less developed parts of the country. And I don't think that's purely a financing issue. I think there are governance and administration issues involved in explaining that outcome. What the debate then raises is an important question about whether cost containment should be centralized or decentralized. In other words, when you are facing budget constraints, should you, as a central authority, be telling each individual spending authority where it must find savings? Or should you be focusing on the total constraint and leaving it to managers to find the best place to raise savings? And I think in the presentation, there was a bit of a tension between the two. Because on the one hand, you were saying in one point in your presentation on the rural app, that let districts decide, just tell districts how much they must save and let them decide where to save. On the other hand, you're saying the national minister must prescribe a guidance. On the one hand, you're saying the determination of what is a critical post is a local issue that must be determined on the basis of what is good for the patients and what is critical in each establishment. On the other hand, you're saying the National Minister of Finance or Health must provide greater guidance on these issues. And I'm just highlighting this to say this is an ongoing tension that we face in as National Treasury, particularly acutely all over the place, because people, including parliamentarians, will tend to say National Treasury must find savings. National Treasury must not do, must allocate money, must find savings, must cut costs. But that's well and good, but often it makes more sense and it's more rational for National Treasury to simply say this is the limit that you face and you as managers decide where the costs are going to be cut. Because often if you make the cuts as National Treasury, what sounds good and seems to make sense at a national level, once you cascade it down into the complex system that we are governing, it has obscene and perverse outcomes that you didn't anticipate at a local level. So you'll say, cut travel budgets. And you don't take into account that some provinces are Gauteng and other provinces are Northern Cape. And the travel, the implication of cutting a travel budget in Northern Cape might have a serious impact on service delivery, whereas in Gauteng it's a excessive expenditure. So this is a tension in how we approach cost containment issues. In general, there's a tendency then to, with the provincial issues, to then want to centralize that as well. And the provinces would say you want to conditionalize the equitable share. In other words, you want to allocate less through the equitable share and more through conditional grants, which is also the kind of direction that we're being pointed in here. There are strengths and weaknesses to that that need to be carefully thought about. As we discuss NHI, the big issue we really need to discuss is what is the future of the health system? What is the role of provinces, districts, and national in the delivery of health services? So we often have a debate about whether we want provinces. Personally, I think a much more useful debate is not whether we want provinces or not, but how should we deliver health services in particular? What is the model for the delivery of health services? And maybe in that context, we will come with solutions. Lastly, just on the taxation issues, I think it's always important, and it's something we always miss, to look at the fiscal system as a whole, not individual taxation. So, for example, when Sweden, after the Second World War, wanted, the Social Democrats came to power and they wanted a dramatic expansion of social services. Initially, it was not clear which taxes were going to finance this dramatic expansion of social services. The Social Democratic Party opposed sales tax. The communists opposed sales tax. The trade union movement opposed sales tax. The bourgeoisie opposed sales tax. Everyone opposed it. But through the political process, it was realized that other taxes, firstly, had reached such a high level that it was difficult to proceed in any other way. And secondly, from a growth point of view, taxation on consumption is less damaging than taxation on income. And thirdly, there was a need to spread the burden more widely across the whole population. So initially, it was actually some of the economists from the trade union movement that broke ranks and moved over to a position of saying that sales tax should be the next wave of funding the situation. And I'm quoting here from a study by an economist called Peter Lindert, who has a magisterial study of public spending across the world. And he says that by the end of the 50s, the finance minister had come to agree and the Social Democrats began to waver, realizing that raising taxes on capital income would risk capital flight from Sweden. They needed coalition partners to stay in power, however. In the end, the Social Democratic Party leaders correctly guessed that the communists would not dare vote no and risk dissolving the government at a time when they were unpopular. The communists abstained and the sales tax was reinstated. Once in place, it became an escalator that the Social Democrats rode to ever higher social budgets. Now, in Sweden, the VAT rate today is 27%. In the US, which has the most regressive fiscal system in the world, there is no VAT. So when we talk about individual taxes, we must locate them in a debate about the entire fiscal system and how progressive or regressive and widely based that system is. And within that system, you can have different instruments that achieve particular objectives. Thanks. And of course, we will respond more on Friday.
Thank you, Michael. Umbul Karim.
Reminder, we're here on Friday. Two is the MTB PS report will be available latest by Monday noon. We're voting on it on Tuesday. Three is the debate is on Wednesday afternoon. The norm is, I think, the report is read out and then each party makes a declaration, but I'll discuss it with Mr. Mania in a moment. And we also, I think next week, Tuesday, should put the Twin Peaks bill in some form or another on the agenda. Can you speak to Cindy about it? Because we don't need, I would imagine to vote on the MTBPS report will take about an hour at most. So we mustn't lose the other 2 to 3 hours. So I think we should put the Twin Peaks bill on. Okay, so having said that, is there anything you want to round up? I mean, I don't know, we don't have any other issues. Oh, yes, the program for the committee means that, we now can't go to Bainbridge in the first week of December because we're sitting here. And I looked at the program last night, the week after is actually constituency period. So I don't know about other parties, but the ANC doesn't allow us to use constituency period to do parliamentary work. So what I'm suggesting is we're going to Bainbridge come what may. But rather we do it, the first week is difficult when people are all over the country for the secretaries to pull it together. In the second week of the committee week, I think we just go for 48 hours because it's about 3 hours from Polokwane, right? So, you know, we will need to spend the night there and then we'll zoom out the following evening, the last flight out from Polokwane, Joburg, wherever we're going, Cape Town, presumably. So are we agreeing? Well, there's not much choice. We can't do it this year. So can you just let SARS know that we're seeking to do it once the parliament towards the end of January, probably the first few days of February. Okay. Anything else? Let's ask off, Matt. I don't know if you've got any issues. Thank you.
On Tuesday, we meet here on Friday again as a joint meeting. And then on Tuesday again, when we vote, the two committees will vote separately, but we will be in the same venue. And we also table the MTBBS and the NSUP on Wednesday the 9th at the same time. Honourable members, thank you for your presence, your contributions. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.